I want to introduce Michael Rubin to you. Michael is really a friend of mine, and his father is also a friend. His father is the president of an M&A firm here in town, MDR and Associates.
MDR Associates.
And so maybe you've run into him. But I met Michael when he was a senior in high school at Prosper, and have watched him go to Texas Tech and mature as a man, and married a beautiful wife, and they've got now one child,
maybe 2-year-old.
Two-year-old
boy.
And anyway, incredible family. And Michael was a financial advisor for several years, and then about a year and a half ago became on staff with Commerce Street, and that's where I got to know Dory. And he is the leading business development officer for Commerce Street. So I'm going to let him take the floor here and also to introduce Dory. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Just a pleasure to be here, as Mike said. Michael Rubin, business development at Commerce Street Capital. And just really excited to introduce Dory, who's going to tell you a little bit about our firm. And then we're going to talk about how to replicate Yale's success and what they've done within their endowment. If you don't know anything about Dory Wiley, he is the CEO and president of our investment bank. And he was also the chairman of the Teacher Retirement Systems of Texas for 10 years. Very successful story. Took that pension fund from a bottom quarter performer to a top performer in the country. So no one better to talk about portfolio management. He's a portfolio manager by heart. And happy to introduce him, Dory.
I always laugh about that. You get claps beforehand. You're like, wait a minute, you don't know if I'm any good or not. Thank you for having me out here. Can you hear me okay in the back? My hearing aids aren't working that well, so if I start yelling at you, I'm not mad at you. I'm just deaf. So yeah, I was laughing when I saw this title. That when I've done this talk for a number of years, and I used to have it called "How to Beat Yale in Investment Management." And then when they sent me the draft, it had this on here, and I didn't change it, and I meant to. And I think they did that because this year we didn't beat them. But normally when we did at least the 10-year returns, we beat them. So I think they were trying to alternate the name, and I didn't change it. So maybe it's how to get close to beating Yale most of the time. But as you know, in investments is it's not an exact science. It changes all the time, and it may be the most humbling business there is, and by the time we all figure it out, we'll all be in a coffin, right? But it's a neat business because it requires humility and wisdom as well as smarts, and you have to check your ego at the door, sort of like baseball, right? We know we're not going to bat 1,000, and that's painful for us as investors because no one likes to lose money. The question is, how do we minimize it? How do we become risk managers? Because if we know we're not going to buy 1,000, we've got to be a risk manager. So I actually consider myself a risk manager first before an investor. So what we're going to talk a little bit about today is portfolio performance, some thoughts about that. What I really want to do is just challenge you to think, because investing is just the little things on the margin that really kind of add up to making the difference. There's really nothing new under the sun, and we all kind of try to steal ideas from each other. So I'm not going to talk about probably the most important thing, which you guys are really good at, which is customer service, hand-holding, all the other things that you do. This is just strictly about performance. Next page. Whew. Can y'all see all that? Go to the next page. So just a little bit. I don't know if you can read all that or not. But anyway, a little bit about Commerce Street. We have a holding company. We have a broker-dealer. And we have a RIA. A broker-dealer is a deal business. It's a transaction business, buying and selling businesses. Half that business is banks. We're one of the top 5 firms in the country for the last 25 years in doing banks. The other half is agnostic, oil and gas, real estate, healthcare, manufacturing, really kind of anything. We get a lot of referrals from our banks, a lot of referrals from RIAs, and that's a nice business. Now, on the investment side, we don't really do what you guys do. We're kind of more of a product shop, and we do different things. One is we're in the retirement business, the 401k business. We're a fiduciary. So we have a great product that we can either be the advisor on or team up with someone, and they can be the advisor, and we do all the work as a fiduciary. We do separate managed accounts. That's part of the thing, business. Separate managed accounts, outsource CIO, alternative asset. You know, you can kind of design and pick what you want. That's where Matt and his team work. He's got a long background in alternatives. We have internal private equity funds, particularly on the banking side, and also on the SBIC side. We have about $2 billion in management of the SBIC program, which is mezzanine and private equity funds. So there's a lot of different things over there, and we just design products. Out of the broker-dealer, we do sell alts. We sell direct deals, and we sell funds, third-party funds, and we also do sponsored equity deals. So we're a very opportunistic firm. That's enough on us. So go to the next page. All right. So just some questions. I just want to challenge you to kind of think on portfolio management. It's a tough business. We're all competing against Goldman, J.P. Morgan, or whatever, you know, it's very tough to outperform over long periods of time. And it's something I've been thinking about for a number of years. And one of the ways you differentiate yourself with is service, right? So if I'm not going to talk about that today, I'm going to talk about performance. Then here are some things that I like to just think about. Who is on my side, right? Who is on my side? So if I'm a pension fund or a foundation or a family office or whatever, not so much you guys, but, you know, where are the conflicts, right? Where are the conflicts? If somebody's selling me managing a fund, how are they getting paid? How does it work? So it's not just track record, but it's just how are the interests aligned? Are people selling a product to me? Who are they representing? Are they a fiduciary in what they do? And benchmarks. You're going to hear me today really hound on benchmarks. Because I find it really interesting in our industry how much is not benchmarked on portfolios. It's a lot of work, right? Especially if you get into alts, because the timing of all the cash flows and the performance measurement is really difficult. But the way I liken to portfolio performance is sort of like if I'm playing basketball or football, right, at college. You know, well, I really don't care if we have a winning season. Well, we won most of our games. We won some of our games. Well, how did our peers do? Well, I don't really know. Or how do we measure up again? Well, I'm not really sure, but we felt good while we were. It's sort of like a participation award. And it's amazing how much a portfolio management is a participation award. Look at 401ks, for example. Most of them, 90% of them don't beat benchmarks, right? A lot of fees in there, conflicts of interest, a lot of them don't act as a fiduciary. But, you know, how'd your 401k do? Well, it went up this year. Yeah, you know, it was up 20%. Well, the market was up 30%. Well, I don't know. I feel good. At least it's up. Right? What's a participation award? You know, and there's no accountability of it. You know, and so and for us, I'm kind of like, there's no reason for us to be in 401ks unless we bring that. Why? Because there's millions of 401k providers out there. There's no reason for us to be in portfolio management unless we can outperform. Right? Because what we don't what? We're not service providers. We're products. Right? There's a lot of people can get the participation award, but what if you can get the performance award and the service award? That's kind of all right, go to the next page. So what kind of fiduciary role are you in? Now this kind of gets back to asking questions of a client. Maybe it's a pension fund or whatever. But people really underestimate the risk of a fiduciary. And there are literally 10,000, over the last 10 years, 10,000 lawsuits that are fiduciary over the last 10 years. It's amazing how people underestimate that. And the worst offender is getting back to 401ks, right? Because that business started 40 years ago is what? I'm an insurance company, and I'm selling you my product. I'm Fidelity, and I'm selling you my fund. And you can't use my platform unless you buy my funds, right? So, I mean, they just changed that 3 years ago to an open architecture. Well, what's wrong with that? Think about it. If we are in internet and cable and phone, right, we can bundle all that up and give you a better deal, better, you know, and hide the cost. That's fine. But doing that in 401k world, we got a problem. Why? Because it's ERISA. It's Department of Labor. There's people responsible for that. Fiduciaries, it's the company. And so they go out and they go, oh, well, I hired, this came right out of a lawsuit. I hired John Hancock. I should be fine. I'm Walmart. I hired John Hancock, and I got sued by my employees for conflict of interest and fees and overcharging and underperformance and monitoring. But I hired John Hancock, Your Honor, or ladies and gentlemen of the jury. John Hancock comes to the stand, not the signer, but the company, and he sits there, and they sit there, and he says, "I'm not a fiduciary. I'm selling a product." And then Walmart's surprised, and they write a check, and so does Boeing, and so does IBM, and so does International Paper, and so do literally hundreds of these laws. There's 64 pages of them right now, all because of this. What role am I in? Where are the conflicts? What's going on? So we saw that as an opportunity for us. But I bring up the 401k side because sometimes this happens. These issues are all the same, right? What's my performance? What's my benchmark? You know, the courts have taken this view that passive is better than active, rightly or wrongly. And they're generalized with it, which I think is wrong. 90% of active funds underperform, passive funds, right? Well, to me, it's like, well, it depends. You know, you talk about large cap or international small cap. You know, there's a difference. Court really doesn't make that a lot of sense. So if you don't have index funds in your 401k, you could be liable. If you have active funds and they're underperforming a comparative index fund, you could be liable. Now, all these things are already done in the court cases. And the point being is, even if they don't transcend over into other areas of finance, the question is, do we have a best practices issue? Do we have a best practices issue? You know, because what we find in every single 401k plan is a monitoring problem of underperformance. So when I was at TRS, we would look at our managers, and we're long-term people, right? So I've got 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year. And I look at 1 year for entertainment, 3 years, hard questions. You don't have good answers, you're gone. But I don't see any problems with 5 year or 10 year performance. You know, there's got to be outperformance. They need to be top quartile, top decile, whatever you're trying to do. So we're talking about active, passive fees, right? That shows up in all these court cases. But where are my fees? Where are we in our industry? Fees are what? Coming down, right? And so in a courtroom, at least on the fiduciary side, you know, where you are in fees is really important. Really important. So, you know, our deal is there's no reason for us to be in this business if we can, unless we can create a better product at a lower price. Now, that's what our textbook says don't do, right? You don't go deliver a Neiman Marcus product at a Walmart price, right? But for us, a product shop, we figured there was no way we can grow unless we do. You know, if I had that service side to it, that you guys do, you know, hand-holding the client, that's where the fees are. That's where the fees are. But you want to have product that's lower fees. You know, so if I'm competing against J.P. Morgan or Goldman or whatever, we know we can probably outperform, right? And their fees are usually higher. But we need to have lower fees, at least as competitive on service, and better performance. And so that's what we're trying to deliver wholesale to either RIAs, advisors, or banks. We have a lot of bank clients. This is really an interesting. Too many choices, too many asset classes. And this is a question kind of in 401k land. But one of the lawsuits that developed out there started with a Dallas pension fund attorney that showed up on 60 Minutes. And he likened it to a McDonald's coffee lawsuit or the tobacco lawsuit. And the comparative is if we give, my assistant, who's got a high school education, and the door, he's got all these letters by his name because he's insecure and low self-esteem, and now he thinks he's smart. But we put these choices in front of him and go, pick your retirement choices, right? Pick your retirement. Think about all the people that come to you and go, what would I pick, right? I mean, how many times have you done that for free? What would I pick on my 401k, right? They have no clue. Even engineers, doctors, even finance professionals, even bankers, they don't know. So here I've got this high school professional. She picks, I pick. 20 years later, I have more money than she does, and I get sued. Why? You forced her to pick knowing she didn't have the expertise to do so. So the industry came out and said, all right, we'll come out and do target date funds, right? And then now we'll take that choice away from you. Except what? They're not fiduciaries on the target date fund. And so John Hancock, anybody work for John Hancock and you? Okay, good. So John Hancock has 98 funds in their target day fund, and what do? They use it to launch new funds, and they put in front-end fees, the 12B1 fees, the exit fees, and they're using it to launch product. They're not a fiduciary on that. In fact, none of them are a fiduciary on their target day funds. So it creates what opportunity to do models or portfolios where you can be. That's one of the things that we want. So too many options. This shows up particularly in the 403B plans for colleges and universities, but they have tons of positions out there. And it's amazing how many universities where you go see these PhDs, even in finance, and they're going, I don't know what to do. I was talking to the CIO of a university who runs a $2 billion endowment, and he was looking at the retirement plan. He goes, I have no idea what to do. Yeah, because think about it. He's got to analyze all the underlying funds and fund families and performance, and who has that kind of time? Not even the CIO running the endowment. I thought that was interesting. So a lot of them have been sued, including Yale, MIT, Harvard. There was 13 of them named in August of 4 years ago, right, on too many selections. Who would have thought in a free country giving people selections was a problem? It is a problem. They don't know what to pick. Governance. This is the number one problem I see in entities that manage money. Not for what you got to do, but for entities, endowments, foundations, etc. So we do a talk in pension funds, and 96% of pension funds in Texas can't beat a 60-40, right? Now we might go, well, it depends on when you measure the 60-40. They never beat it. They never beat it. Why? Because they don't have the right governance set up. If we look at the asset allocation, they had kind of the same asset allocation roughly that the bigger pensions funds did that outperformed it. What was the problem? They didn't know how to pick what they were doing in stocks, bonds, or alternative assets. And the problem in alternative assets is what? If you underperform, the gap is massive. If you outperform, the gap is massive. So they didn't have the expertise. Next. So how do we figure out what to do now? What are the top portfolio managers doing? So that's where David Swensen comes in. Everybody know who David Swensen is? Well, he passed away. But he's written two books. He ran the Yale Fund for up until he died, I guess, last year of cancer, bless his heart. And he's the one that kind of started moving from stocks, bonds as an alternative. Right? And quite frankly, that's what we did when I was a teacher of retirement system. We're a $100 billion fund, which had too much risk in stocks and bonds. We had about a 4% allocation to all. Somehow that's not going to work. It doesn't move the needle. We need to move it up to about 30%, you know, and we'll lower risk. So I get 10,000 letters from teachers telling me what an evil person I was. I was increasing risk. I'm like, no. We're going to decrease risk. We're going to smooth out the returns and decrease risk. And I'll show you how to do it. And then when we became number one in the country and we had the number one private equity portfolio for 10 straight years, I didn't get a lot of letters from teachers, but that's okay. That's okay. But what are other people doing? What are other people? What are the top portfolio managers doing? How are they doing it? What are they doing? What should I not do? What can I do? What can I feasibly do? Can we do what Yale does? Right? Like I tell people, you want me to build you a top quartile private equity portfolio. Great, give me at least $300 million and I'll check back with you in 7 years, right? I got to get through the J curve and this, that, and that. Well, who's got that kind of time? But it's amazing how many people do that. I was talking to a pension fund. It was $2 billion in size. They had these two young guys, in their, one in late 20s, one early 30s. And he said, yeah, we talked to a consultant. We want to get into private equity, and we're going to start investing in private equity deals. So I said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. He goes, why? And I go, you're not going to be here in 7 years. And then you're going to go get a job from this guy, and you're going to come over here and apply to Todd. And Todd's going to go, what's your track record? Well, I was in the J curve. You want a track record that you can own, right? It's like being a football coach. Are you a winner or are you a loser? You know, what did I do with this place? And so I said, what you need to do is start out with a private equity portfolio that gets a return now, that helps add safety to the portfolio now. And then if you want to gradually fund some direct private equity investments or fund investments that have J curves, do it out of that. But you don't want to be a drag on the rest of the portfolio for 7 years. You know, then it's amazing how many people in the country, probably 95% that start their programs, don't think about that. They have no thought about it. They just say, oh, yeah, I want to start doing private equity, and I'm going to have negative returns for a while because I know in 7 years I'll be doing great. What if you invest for 7 years and it turns out you made bad investments? I don't want to know that I'm bad in 7 years. I'd like to know that now, right? So what is feasible? Well, Yale has fund access to some hedge funds and some venture funds that A, they have higher minimums, and B, don't take any more investors. So there are some things that some people do that we can't do, right? And so knowing what you can do and what you can't do, not only feasibility in the marketplace, but capability and expertise is important. It's really, because sometimes you're hamstrung. Sometimes you're in a part of a bigger organization and they only feed you a certain amount of things, right? So you have to work with what they give you. And sometimes it limits you quite a bit. Some of these firms are not real good at some things as they are others. All right, next. So Yale's influence on that, they competed with Harvard for many years, and then Harvard decided, you know what? We can run our own hedge fund. We're gonna add 100 people, and we're gonna run our own hedge fund internally, and we can do this on our own. And they got rid of their guy because they didn't want to pay him jack. They didn't want to pay him $20 million a year anymore. They thought they could just replicate it and do it on their own. Instead, they blew up. They did terrible, and they underperformed 60-40 for 10 years. And they're still trying to get better and go back to what they used to. Swenson, he's kind of gotten celebrity status, like I was saying. If you get a chance to get his books, they're very well done. Even though they're a little dated, they're still very, very good. And he's the one that really kind of brought on the influence of this outsourced chief investment officer, or call it endowment model, that a lot of people try to replicate. Next page. So Yale's endowment reached $42 billion, posting the highest return since 2000 with a 40% rate of return at the end of 2020. All these endowments killed it last year. They killed it. I mean, big numbers. What's funny is a certain university did 27% last year, right? And they come to the meeting and they go, oh, we did really good. We did really good. We got 27%. We're tired of sucking. You know, and I didn't have the heart to tell them while they were still in the bottom quartile. And then they didn't benchmark. So it's like scoring 27 points in a football game and thinking you won when you got beat 75-27. You know, that might make any sense. And that is, what is that problem? That's a governance problem. Right? When everybody in the room starts clapping on their performance, nobody has a clue what they're doing governance-wise because they have no idea how important benchmarking is. That's a participation award. We got 27 points and we got a blue ribbon for participation. Amazing how many billions of dollars are run that way. So this is just all about what I told you before. And here's a little deal on their allocation. 55% private equity and venture capital, 21% hedge funds, 10% foreign equity, 9% real estate, 3.5% natural resources, 0.9% domestic equities. Wow, we've come a long way from a 60-40, 70-30, 40-60 model, haven't we? Isn't that amazing? But they can do that not only because they're an endowment that just has a 5% payout, because Yale does not need $42 billion under any scenario. Under any scenario. Okay? So not everybody can run money like that. Right? Is there another way? Go to the next page. So here are the asset allocations. They change a little bit over time. We track that. But you got the general idea of what I was talking about. Go to the next page. Passive versus active. Now, we talked about that a little bit. Why do active managers fail? And you guys know this. Now, we all get in when we're 20-something years old. But, hey, I can pick stocks better than the other guy because I can now analyze them. I'm a CPA. I'm a CFA. I got my MBA, and I'm smart, and I can pick stocks better than others. I'm a fundamental guy. I'm a growth guy. I'm a momentum guy, whatever it is, right? And then we all learn after a while, that's pretty hard to do. But we also learn a lot of other things, high transaction costs, impact costs, right? We create tax issues with our client. And it's kind of hard to be an index over a long period of time in certain assets, right? Because we know, say, like in large caps, right? The difference between a large cap manager, top quartile and a bottom quartile large cap manager is maybe 75 beeps. And it's only because of the way they tilt. And they want to be able to say they outperformed in the last 3 years. But over 5, 10 years, 15 years, not many of those, right? But in international small cap, we can find some. We can find them in small cap. We can find them in high yield, maybe emerging markets. But we have to be careful about what we do. This is where people lose the most money, though, especially in 401ks. Probably on average 5% a year. 5% a year. Just chasing funds, chasing returns. It's the worst enemy. We lower costs, we lower expenses, but we try to educate people. Hey, stop trading. Stop doing that. Yes.
What's the difference in performance between managers and private markets?
We're going to get into that.
Okay.
All right, next page. So we covered that. Go to the next page because we don't have all that time to go through all these. So possible solutions to underperformance. This is as if I'm talking to you as a pension fund or something like that, or a small city fund. You know, merge with somebody else that has, so you can get the experience, right? Or change what you're doing. But status quo is not an option. Status quo is not an option. Because you're a fiduciary. And fiduciary rules and laws and lawsuits are going to increase. They're not going to decrease. Go to the next page. So here's another way. Focus on benchmark, right? So let's say I'm a university, okay? And there's a thing that comes out once a year called NCUBO, right? The National Association of College and Universities Boards or whatever. But it's all the university performance. How do I perform against all the universities on average, top quartile, top decile? Create another benchmark. How do I perform against the top decile? Another benchmark. How do I perform against all the universities that are my size? Right? How do I compete against all the universities in the Big 12? How do I compete against all the universities in Texas? Right? I like multiple benchmarks because I learn from every one of them and how we are. So many people are afraid to measure performance because why? Well, I like participation reward because I don't do very well. You know, you can do well. And it starts with knowing what your performance is. There's a saying in management, right? If I can't measure it, I can't manage it. It's the same in money. If I can't measure it, I can't manage it. And so I'm really big about benchmarks. We talked about resources, what works for us, what makes sense. What I've noticed in money, big is bigger, but it's not better. Right? There are many small funds and things that do much better than big funds. And so big is bigger, but not better. Buyer beware, line of interest. Just because somebody has a brand name on Wall Street Reporter does not mean they're better. I have a saying, just because somebody from New York, I've commuted up there for years, but just because somebody from New York tells you a Wolverine makes you a good house bet, doesn't mean you should go buy it. You can tell I'm from West Texas. But spend more time on risk management, asset allocation, what resources you have, fees, be a fee warrior, the common sense, and find the egos and look for humility, right? Eliminate the egos in investment management, whether that be in your shop or whether that be in the products that you have or the people running that. Because if somebody doesn't have you build, not to get too carried away on the good book, but the good book tells us what? The first step to wisdom is what? Humility. Humility, right? And that's a big problem in investing. Everybody's got a big ego. All right, next page. So let's start with big benchmarking. I've talked about NCUBO, what it was. Let's go to the next page. So it just came out like this last week. All right. So it's hard for you to see this, but these numbers are huge. Look at this: 57% 1 year from Bowdoin College, and Yale is number 7 this year. Boy, they're getting their butt kicked. Usually they're in the top 3 or 4. Princeton was number 1 last year. I can tell you this, these 10-year returns, which is really what I'm looking for, 10-year returns, these are all double digits. Last year, the 10-year returns were all single digits. That's how big this one-year deal affected the 10-year numbers. So it's really pretty amazing. So if I want to be in percentile, right, and forget the 1 year because I don't care about that, but if I want to be in the top 10 percentile, I had to be 10.2. And if I want to be top quartile, 9.1. So this is a good goal, 9.1 over 10 years. This is a better goal. And if I get top 5%, great. But you're going to flutter around here. So we run this every year. we run this every year, and we plot our portfolios and what we're doing, and usually we're 1, 2, or 3 or something like that. We're going to be a little bit lower because our allocation, a lot of our models, is only 20% to private equity. And these guys all have massive allocations to private equity. So we have the numbers, but I'll show you in a minute. But it's not as high as it normally is. Next page. But it's a benchmark, right? Knowing what other people do. You know, get access to it and see what they're doing. It's a great way to learn. Because you might go, well, I can't create exactly what they're doing, but there's probably other ways to see how I'm doing against it. So this gets back to what Michael asked me. We talked about the difference in, this is global equity, right? Top quartile, bottom quartile, 2.5% difference. I got to be really good, right? Really good to stay in top quartile. Same here. What is that? 80 basis point difference? No, hey, I get into something inefficient like private real estate. Now I can make a difference. Now I can make a big difference. Venture capital, usually this goes negative. But wow. You know, so this is where I should spend my time. Or seek out expertise for me to spend my time. Because this makes a difference. Because remember when I talked to you about the underperformance of all these pension funds and endowments? It's not the allocation so much. It's they do terrible over here. Because if they're small, let's say they're $100 million, $200 million, $500 million, and they don't have a lot of expertise, they'll go to XYZ firm on Wall Street, they get a junior chipmunk that sells them something with a lot of fees and bad performance, and they don't know the difference, right? And maybe that fund has a conflict of interest. Maybe they have a terrible track record. Maybe they just don't know how to underwrite. And they wind up down here. But it's a big problem. Because somebody's buying all these, and they tend to be a lot of pension funds and endowments that have fiduciary and government and benchmarking issues. But it's not that hard. If you don't have the staff, you do what? You outsource it. And then if you do outsource it, benchmark it, right? So if I work for a larger company where everything's got to funnel through for a lot of people and they underwrite, are they being benchmarked? And so many of them aren't. So many of them aren't. How is their private equity pitch doing? How are the platforms on there doing? Benchmark, right? Encourage it because it's killing you. It's killing you if you're not up here. Otherwise, you can do it on your own. Next page. So adding the alternative asset private equity. So we know what it does, right? Hopefully you guys know this. We all know Efficient Frontier and stuff. And the 60-40 does this, right? We've been seeing that, right? You take out QE, you add inflation, and then you throw in Putin, and it's really volatile, right? And it's going to get worse because we're about to hike the rate. And then every 10 years we do what? Every 10 years since 1797, boom, we drop 20%, and we have 20% unemployment or higher. It's clockwork. Happens all the time. It was so bad in the Great Depression, we actually got a 20-year pass in the 50s. But it showed up in the 70s. And then 2008. And then 2000. So every 20 years that shows up. So we got to have something to smooth out the stocks and bonds. Something that smooths them out. And that's what private equity does. So it moves everything over. And that's what we want. We want higher returns with less risk. Next page. Now this is one of my, I'm a risk manager. Everybody knows this, but I love talking about it. If I lose 20% in something, I gotta make 25% to get break even. If I lose 50%, I gotta do 2x to get break even. If I lose 70%, I gotta do 3x, right? But we're getting that, we already dropped what, 20% in NASDAQ and 12% for the year in S&P? This is a problem that increases at an increasing rate to the downside. It's calculus. But we don't have that. It's asymmetric. It doesn't happen on the upside. So in a market like this is our diversification argument, right? We got to lose less than the benchmark, whatever I'm benchmarking, every time it comes down. At least that's the way we try to manage, right? I can't outpick you, but I want to lose less every time. So what I got to do is make sure maybe there's different ways to do that. How my allocation is, what I'm doing in cash, you know, I'll give up some upside to protect some downside so that I do this, especially in 2000, 2008, or 2020 or whatever. And if I can do that, and I have the participation on the upside, even if it's not 1-to-1, I'll win. Why? Because of the calculus on the downside. That's all this is showing. Thank you. Same here, right? 2008, private equity loses less than the public market. Great, it's a break. Now, one of the things I did when I was at TRS, I said, hey, I want enough, sign up another independent auditing firm and do valuations of every one of our private equity positions to make sure that they're all reporting what I really think it is. Okay? Because, you know, it's subjective, right? And if it were a fire sale, it might be a whole lot less. But that's part of the beauty of private markets. It's not a fire sale. Because what we tend to do emotionally when the market goes down is our clients especially, hey, I want to sell, I'm scared. I'm scared. I can't afford it anymore. And they sell at the worst time, and it costs them 10 years of returns. Next page. So when you're doing alts, in particular, be careful, figure out what you want, what works for you, what works for your client, what works for your portfolio, what you're doing. The fees, the structure, the diversification, the volatility, the reporting, the liquidity, the terms, conflicts of interest, whether it's a fund, where it's direct, etc. All of those things. And if you don't have that expertise, find it. It's out there and people will do it for you on a cost-effective basis. Next page. This is just basically talking about 20-year annualized returns, diversification. We get all this. But what's interesting, look at these returns on some of the private markets and stuff. It's just more inefficient to higher return. Next page. What do we do? We don't have the exact answer on how to beat Yale all the time. We have an answer that works. What I wanted to try to hit with you today is there's more than one way. This is a terrible thing to say, I guess, nowadays, not politically correct, but there's more than one way to skin a cat. Right? There's more than one way to do things. So if you can kind of think about all the things that we talked about, there's a lot of ways to do kind of what we'll give you an idea of what we do. Next time. So one of the things we do is I go, you know what? I don't want to try to compete with large cap managers. We're experts at picking banks as an example. We're really good at banks. Well, I'll tell you, hey, I know how to analyze banks and pick banks as that deal, right? But if you make me do a mutual fund of 200 banks and add a fee of 100 basis points on there and then go put it in the public markets and then beat the index, that doesn't sound fun to me. And I think I'm pretty good. But I don't think anybody can do that on a regular basis. That's a hard deal. I don't want to do that. I don't think the benefits of it. It's easier for me to do that in a hedge fund format, which we've done, or a private equity. You asked me to go beat a large cap manager. Can I pick 10 large caps and do that instead of trying to run a fund? You know, that's hard, right? That's really hard. Just buy the index. You know, there was a lawsuit out there. This is back on the 401k side. There was a lawsuit where a 401k had the Vanguard S&P 500 index in the retirement plan. Sounds normal, right? 4 basis points. They had to write a $26 million check because they didn't have Fidelity in there. That's 2 basis points. Now 1 basis point. Think about that as a fiduciary issue. But why is that? Forget the fiduciary, like, they're the same, right? It's a commodity. So why would I pay the 4 basis points over the 1 basis point? I should be Fidelity's S&P 500. Okay? But you can index for beta, active for alpha. You know, where it's hard to get the beta over a long period of time, just index it. It's a lot easier to get it in alts or more less effective areas. So we designed some portfolios that do that. Next page. Here's the kind of the result. These are 10-year returns as of June 30th, 2021. Keep in mind, the big year for private equity. So this is the Boydon College, and they're in first place now. That 1 year really locked them up. Yale is here. Princeton is here. Green line is top quartile. Remember I told you at 9.1%. The median is 8.3%, the bottom quartile is 7.6%. There's no reason to be bottom quartile. Why? Because a monkey can invest in the 60-40 index and beat it. So I hate it when I say that. I'm going to tell you guys this because you're professionals. But I won't do that to endowments or pension funds. But look, this is the monkey. If I can't beat the monkey, I don't need to be in business. Right? I mean, that's crazy. And here's an 80-20, which is probably more comparative to an endowment anyway, right? So it's long-term money. It's long-term money. And where is it? Top quartile. Wow, that puts a lot of pressure on these endowments. Well, most of them underperform because they don't know how to benchmark. They don't know how to look at what everybody else is doing. They don't want to report. You'd be surprised how many colleges and universities don't even report publicly what all they're doing. But if you go to the best ones, this is what we allocate. This is how we perform. They have what? Transparency and accountability, which are the number one things in governance you can have. Transparency and accountability. So the dark blue are some of the models that we use in private equity and separate accounts. Okay? So this is the Commerce Street 60-40. And it does a little bit better than the index, right? And when we add private equity to the 60-40, it has top quartile. And we charge, depending on how much money you put in there, anywhere from 5 basis points to 40 basis. We go as small as $1 million. Did I get that right, Matt? Is that close enough? You put a lot of money in there. It's okay. So you mean I can go play golf, stick money in there, and I'm top quartile in Nakubo? Yeah. For as little as $1 million, $20 million endowment, $200 million, $1 billion endowment? Yeah, you can go play golf. And by the way, most of the time, it'll do better than this. It's just private equity had a bang up here last year. 80-20, look at our 80-20 index here. Way above top quartile. Again, normally it's much higher than that because of private equity. This is with zero private equity. This is our 80-20 with a 20% allocation to private equity. And it's up here pretty good.
Dory, in all those indexes, are you buying, like in private equity, are you buying indexes?
We're buying indexes with a few active funds where we can get the alpha. And so it's real simple. And it's a lineup of about 16 funds. And you'll see names in there like Fidelity and BlackRock and Vanguard and what's not. And we do a little tilting towards the U.S. We do a little tilting under allocation, right? So if it's a 60-40, we might under allocate because we're trying to take less risk to the downside, right? We'll over allocate to mid cap versus large cap. And small cap, because mid cap, right, has pretty much the same volatility as large cap over long periods of time, except it has higher returns because those companies get bought, like by private equity. You can't go buy Exxon, right? So there's no takeout premium on Exxon, but there is in the mid cap. So little things like that help, but other than that, it's not rocket science what we do. It really isn't. We're just big fee warriors. The underlying fund fees on these, probably anywhere from 10 to 14 basis points, something like that. I mean, it's pretty low.
This is a really dumb question, but 80-20, is that 80% more of the money?
80% equity is 20% bond.
20%
bond.
But it's really a
60-20. If it's got equity. Right. If it's got private equity.
60% public.
That's right.
20% private equity.
Yes, private.
20%.
Right. And the actual allocation is, you know, a little bit under because we're trying to take less downside.
And the endowments over on the right, you mentioned earlier, they're doing like 90%.
Yeah, I mean, they're huge. So one of the advantages, I'm glad you brought that, one of the advantages that we have over Yale and all these guys is, one, we don't get $20 million a year to run here. Two, they're not only paying a lot of a 1 in 20, 2 in 20, but 3 in 20 fees on those venture funds. Or 3 in 30, or 2 in 30. Right? So one of the ways we can compete and make it up is what be fee warriors and make it up somewhere else. And what we wanted to do is, and I got this idea, was up here, so I want to bring institutional investing to the average person, you know, at least $1 million. Or to 401ks, which has been treated like retail. You know, it's not retail. It should be institutional. And nobody's treating it like institutional. So that's what we're doing. Yes, sir.
On your buying side, are
fixed income or debt or whatever you want to call it, you're such a big believer in alternative, why don't you use your BDCs or CMOs or collateralized?
No, I don't disagree with you a little bit. What we've done more so on the bond side, and what we'll do is we can tweak these models for however anybody wants. So these are real generalized, and really they start with what we're doing in the 401k. So say the 80-20 and the 60-40 are what we're using in our 401k with some other allocations, but I can't do CMOs, I can't do all that other stuff in there. But so what we do is I figure the Sharpe ratios, right, for risk that I get in bond, that's just not there. It's just not there. So with these models, you'll find that our bond allocations were in higher quality bonds with shorter durations than we are the index or the benchmark, because I'm not getting paid for the risk. And where that's really going to help us, it hasn't helped us the last 10 years, right, at all. It's going to help us going forward with rates going up. I'm ready to start cashing in on that. On that. And then anyway, so that's that. Because there's just not enough extra return per unit of risk. But in a private design, if you come in and said, the more money we have, if you come in with 20 million, 50 million, or 100 million to design something, then we can go, hey, you know, we're doing something for an $8 billion shop right now. We're mass designing a private credit portfolio, a private equity portfolio form, so that we can do that. So you can under allocate bonds and pick it up in all this. Yes, sir.
So you probably use a lot of TAMPs, you know, for farming out to third party managers for that I use. But then for a small piece, right? And I'm not a fund picker, so I use model portfolios.
Yeah.
So is there, but a monkey could use a model portfolio. I'm just facilitating trades and I'm helping them in the right.
Well, these are model portfolios, right? Okay. Unless I've customized it for you, mm-hmm. It's a model portfolio.
So in terms of the lawsuit type things you're talking about, if you're charging somebody a fee to manage it, but it's not your, you know.
Question is, how's the portfolio? If the portfolio's doing good against, say, a 60-40 over 3, 5, and 10 years, you're in great shape. If it's not, you got a problem. And these are cases that have gone to the Supreme Court on a monitoring basis. They haven't shown up in private practice as much as they have under ERISA. But it gets back to what? A best practices issue. I'm not trying to create fear for people involved in it. I'm trying to create an awareness of best practices. Great questions.
Jordan, next question. Where do you think interest rates are moving?
Up.
But is there a breaking point where the U.S. economy, because of the all the deficit spending, can...
Yes, but I don't know that we hit that. If you think about 2000, what was it, 18? Powell raised rates and boom, they lost their nerve, right? Market crash. So we're going to, he just gets named. We got these elections and stuff going on. We got a more volatile market. We can pull QE out, right? We're going to buy a third of the bonds. We've got Russia going on. We've got inflation going on, right? With very cold, very real inflation in food and gas and homes and cars. Question is, I don't think where it caps out. I think it tests the resolve of the Fed. You know, when they hike up rates 7,500 basis points, because they lose their nerve because things get worse, right? The market's giving them the benefit of the doubt that, hey, when the Fed speaks, says, hey, we're going to rise rates, you know, five times this year or whatever, the market kind of rallies and says, oh, good, because that's going to bail us out. That doesn't make sense to me, because how is the market behaving the last 3 years? Remember how weird it was to look at the market and get bad news because the market went up thinking it was going to get more support from Congress? Oh, if we get bad news, they'll give us more money.
So has the Fed lost their nerve for this round? So they're not going to do 50 bips or do seven times a year?
He's acting like he's not going to do 50 more bips, but boy, he sure needs to.
But he won't because he's lost
their nerve. Yeah, so the question is after he does 25, 50, 75 bips or 100, you know, how does his nerve handle it? You know, we need a Paul Volcker, right? Yeah. Who didn't care. He did not care. Just jacked him up and did what we needed to do.
that we got through it, and that's really kind of what we need. It's going to be really interesting. And it's going to be really interesting to see what it does with stocks, right? We see all these technology stocks crashing, and everybody moving the value in a very kind of predictable way in the last 4 or 5 months. It's created some great buying opportunities in these technology stocks because, you know, forget the ones that are trading about 100 PE. I'm talking about something like an Apple or a Microsoft. Right? You get a 25% correction in those stocks where the fundamentals still look really, really good. It creates some incredible buying. You know, and 100 basis point change in rates discount is not going to make any difference in Microsoft. Well, they got a 36% ROE or 36% margin and a 50% ROE. You know, 100 basis point doesn't mean anything.
I'm only asking you this question because I get asked. All of these portfolios are diversified portfolios, multiple asset classes, and different exposures.
What's it done last 10 years? How much?
I'm looking at this. I've got this database here. It's telling me 15.
15.
So what would you tell your hand-holding retail customer that says, hey, I've misinterviewed this book of all the best hedge funds.
So if I'm hand-holding somebody, what I like to include is some graphs and talks about 2000 and 2000. Because that changes everything, right? How do you do with a 2? Because one of the things that I hated about this 10-year thing is once we got 10 years out of 2008, all of a sudden everybody started looking better against us. Because we were in first for a long time, particularly on the target date fund stuff. We were killing people. And the gap of performance is huge. Now our gap is a lot smaller because there's no crash. And it's the crash that kills us, right? It's the temptation. 5 or 10 years to get out of it. So I think it's always important to include a late if you can. And if you do, especially with something that has a diversifier like a low ball like private equity and different kinds of private equity, you go, well, what's the best diversification agent product that you have at Commerce Group right now for low ball and downside risk? I would say, oh man, we've got this guy in Dallas that manages industrial properties. His family's been doing it for 75 years, and we know industrial properties are really low, and they don't correlate with real estate, they don't correlate with other markets, it's just like this. And what else do we know? Amazon needs another warehouse. And as long as they need another warehouse, and these guys are buying everything all in at 80% of replacement costs, I don't need to know a whole lot more. Right? What do they return? 12 to 14% a year, like clockwork with a 5.5% dividend. And they make a market in it. It's a really cool product. It's a great product. They've been doing it a long time. And I love that product mixed in with private equity and other things. It's really nice. I'm a downside risk guy. I start there. I start my portfolio, I start with downside risk. And the way I do, whether it be an direct investment, a fund, or a portfolio, and I'm not saying this is the right way, it's just the way I think, is I define risk, I want to reduce risk and make more money. If I don't make more money, I didn't define the risk correctly. So for example, if I dial up the risk in 1 year, I can probably beat everybody, right? If I'm lucky. But if I dial up the risk, can I do that for 10 years? 5 years? No, the truth starts to manifest itself much more. And can I do it through 2008 or 2000 or 1929 or 1987 or whatever. Next page. So summary, benchmark, whatever you're doing, not just your portfolios, but whatever you're outsourcing, either your managers, your private equity, your venture capital, or your real estate, make sure it's benchmark. Because there's so many times we get a participation award rather than a winning award. And we want to win. And the difference between winning and participation in this business, a lot of times, is just knowing. And so benchmark. Make sure you benchmark. And define a tough peer group.
it's okay. Because you know what's cool? You can steal what they're doing. So if we look at Mike Leach, right, we'll talk about Texas Tech. Mike Leach, and so all of a sudden he shows up at OU and he hangs 70 points on A&M, right? And Tech's like, who is this guy? All of a sudden OU's good and they don't suck anymore. And so we steal him as a head coach. Next thing you know, we're scoring 70 points on Nebraska at their homecoming and beating them. Nobody's done that before. Wow. And next thing you know, he's got this coaching tree. Next thing you know, all these people run his offense all over the place, right? That happens in football, whether Wishbone back in the day or what Mike Leach is doing. Same way with Mark Adams, right? He starts this little defense and does it under Chris Pierce. Next thing you know, all these teams in the Big 12 are doing it. And Baylor's doing it, and they win the Big 12. Not only the Big 12, but the national championship. Same thing, portfolio management. Find out what the winner's doing. Learn from them. We talked about defining risk. Keep things simple. I find that one of the things, particularly on the institutional side, and particularly with Wall Street, is more complicated, more PhDs, more science I put in it, the more complicated it is. Client doesn't understand. They figure it's complicated, so it must be right. You can keep it simple. For beta, be a fee warrior, right? You know, it's the first thing I did at TRS. I'm not paying for market exposure. I got $100 billion here. I don't want to pay anything, you know. Get it below one basis point. For alpha, okay, net of fees, what do you do? What's the reward? Risk reward. You know, shoot for top quartile or top decile or whatever, but track it. And then adjust as needed. It's not an exact science. I don't have a lot of quotes because I'm not good at that kind of stuff, but I did think about this a long time ago. Investing, because it's a balance, right? It's not exact science. Investing is a function of balancing discipline against emotion and conviction against discipline, right? So sometimes, you know, you get real heavy convictions and you just know you're wrong. That's hard because you have to balance that against the discipline you put in the portfolio. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. You know, 2008 happens, TRS also. You know, I'm getting calls. I'm just on the board. I'm getting calls from all over the world, all hours of the night. Hey, I've got the, you know, people want to liquidate because they got to sell stuff, fire stuff. I got to sell $100 million of this, $1 billion of that. And we have the quick. The question is what we were going to do. And I met with the guys and said, look, I know we've got our allocation, but we need to go buy all the senior debt we can with these big 25-50% discounts for these companies that we think are AAA and A. And I got a lot of pushback from staff. Well, that doesn't fit in our allocation. So we got to change the allocation. And one of the guys says, but we can't because we got all this stuff in the, you know, in stocks and this. I said, you don't understand. We own all that debt in stock in these companies. Why wouldn't we want to move up the capital stack and get a locked in 25-50% gain? Would you rather own the stock of something you don't believe in or the senior debt at a 25-50% discount? So we moved $10 billion into that. And we did the very first allocation in the country and called it, we made up the name, called it opportunistic debt. And what's interesting is now, almost everyone has an opportunistic debt allocation because interest rates have been a problem for all this time. Another one is in these dips, just personal trading. I don't do a lot of trading. I do most of my stuff with people. We call them core allocation strategies because I know I already compete with David Swenson, right? So don't screw it up, Dory, by thinking you're too smart. So I do a lot of this. But I keep a little money on the side and buy this and that. And so I'll do some spots on CNBC or Fox or whatever. And it's like, well, what are you doing in this market? And I go, well, I'm kind of an emotional guy, so I'll take the emotional out of it. I just watch the VIX. If it hits 35, I buy something. Because there's probably blood in the street that day, and I'm buying something. And so I'll find something fundamentally that I really like, and then I'll buy it. So that's just some examples. You can come up with that. But that's just an example of using conviction against discipline. Sometimes it doesn't matter. But for 90% of the time, it's a function of balancing discipline against emotion. And that's what you have to deal with in handholding your clients, which is really hard.
All right, any questions?
For those of you that I saw taking pictures of the presentation, I'd be happy to send that to you. Just give me your business card and I'll email it over.
Business card.
Y'all been very kind to have me out here. I'm very humbled to be in front of you and look forward to getting to know you better. Thank you very much.
Dory, thank you so much for keeping it. Before you run off, Dory, we learned something here at FSU.